The 2005 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 373, a panel entitled When Beliefs Lead to Estrangement, with Carolyn Campbell, Ardeen Watts, Morgan Smith, Julian Hatch, Dwayne Jennings, Dennis and Ronnie Higley, Alex Nibley, and Mary Beth Rains.
Okay. Welcome to session 373, When Beliefs Lead to Estrangement. As I was preparing for this panel, it struck me how often the Sunstone Symposium is a bridge beyond estrangement, and how often a lot of people's paths cross during these sessions that wouldn't cross in other ways. And people from different walks of life, different segments of society, different beliefs gather together. And so I'm thrilled to be here today, and I'm thrilled to have all of you here. At the suggestion of Mary Beth Rains, we will have each of our panelists introduce himself and then, within a five-minute span, discuss briefly the results of his estrangement or of his ability to avoid estrangement, and then give, for the remainder of the 5 minutes, his personal story. And at Mary Beth's suggestion, I did bring a timer. And at the end of that, after each person has presented 4 or 5 minutes, then we will open the discussion to questions, and we will also limit each of those to 5 minutes. And we will proceed in the following order. We will start with Alex Nibley, and then Dwayne Jennings, and then Morgan Smith, then Julian Hatch, and then Ardeen Watts, and then we will hope that Mary Beth Rains has arrived by that time. Appreciate your consideration and your willingness to be here today. Thank you. We'll begin with Alex.
I hope this is 5 minutes. I'll talk fast. I've been asked here to speak about estrangement because of recent publicity surrounding my sister Martha Beck's book. I will not go into the conflict about whether Dad was a pedophile. Martha claims he abused her. I don't believe her. But Hugh Nibley's not the only abuser described in Martha's book. The portrait she draws of herself is a person willing and able to inflict pain when it suits her purposes. Behavior has brought me a great personal pain, and yet I love her. If I did not, she could not wound me so deeply. I may be here under false pretext, because Martha's estrangement from her family is not, as she portrays it, as a result of difference in faith. Estrangement is about pain. It's often about the choice between keeping a painful, non-functioning, and possibly life-threatening limb or amputation. It's a Sophie's choice with no good answer. The psychologist Viktor Frankl was interned in Auschwitz and tells a story of how he risked his life to stand up to a camp guard who accused him of being a lazy businessman when Frankl knew himself to be a doctor. He writes, quote, "There are moments when indignation can arouse even a seemingly hardened prisoner, indignation not about cruelty or pain, but about the insult connected with it. That time, blood rushed to my head because I had to listen to a man judge my life who had so little idea of it." Here, the pain of being portrayed falsely eclipsed all the physical agony of Auschwitz. That's how I feel when Martha lies about my life. It's a theft of my soul, a rape of my persona. Martha's complained in a press release that she was not invited to participate in this conference. This is ironic since Martha's gone to great lengths to prevent open discussion of her book, including threatening to sue Sunstone and a lot of other people if they didn't tell her story the way she wants. When Martha went before millions of people on Good Morning America, my sister Christina and I sat in a hotel room across the street and watched her lie about us because the network would not let us on to respond to her. KRCL Radio banned us from answering her accusation that we covered up for a child molester and said they were doing us a favor because it would only sell more books. On the record, I am willing in any forum to discuss with Martha the evidence of her book. Please set it up, anybody here who can. One of the most hurtful lies Martha tells about her family is that we rejected her because she has taken a stand against the Mormon Church. She knows this is bullshit. She was not the first Nibley to leave the church, and nobody was ever spurned by this family for speaking against the church. We have made countless efforts over the years to maintain contact with her, which she has resisted. When I called her to tell her Dad had died, she refused to take my call. She refused to come to the funeral where all of us, with all our different opinions on Mormonism, made our peace with Dad. As I read Martha's book, the big question was this: does Martha really believe all this horseshit? She writes with such conviction I had to wonder about her sanity, or my own sanity. We didn't have nicknames in our family. That's news to Tom and Mike and Becky. I switched to my middle name because I hated it when my family called me Chaz. We weren't allowed to call our parents Mom and Dad. Weird. I've never heard anyone call Mom Mother, ever. And Dad is Dad. Our mother demanded the girls consider only homemaking as a life activity. Then how did they all end up as professionals with Mom's full support? Believe me, I could go on for hours. There are literally hundreds of these lies in Martha's book. Martha should know these things are false, but there she was on TV telling another whopper about how we supported her story until she threatened to go public. Millions of people lapping it up while we sat there across the street feeling like we were going insane. I'm not a psychologist, but a lot of things about Martha started to make sense when I began to study narcissistic personality disorder. Dr. Sam Vakden has written extensively on NPD and describes what it's like having a narcissistic loved one. It fits my experience of Martha to a T. I'll edit out the top section. So, if you're a victim of a narcissist, what kind of life can you look forward to? You will be required to deny yourself, your hopes, your dreams, your fears, your aspirations, your sexual needs, your emotional needs, and sometimes your material needs. You will be asked to deny reality and ignore it. It is very disorienting. Most victims feel that they are going crazy or that they are guilty of something obscure, opaque, and ominous. It is Kafkaesque, an endless ongoing trial without clear laws, known procedures, and identified judges. It is nightmarish. Well, the Nibleys were not raised to kiss ass. When Martha found her siblings too strong-minded to dictate our reality, she cut us off and surrounded herself with those more willing to affirm what she has said without being troubled by facts. My cousin Sylvia has been in several of the sessions of this conference representing Martha. In earlier sessions, she has spoken of love, how she loves all her family, her cousins, and her uncle, Hugh. Indeed, Martha claims to love the man she says raped her when she was 5, and she told the Salt Lake Tribune, "I hope I can live the rest of my life to honor his memory," as paradoxical as that seems. Let me read a few excerpts from Martha's book and let you decide about her honor and love. Martha's in a hotel room with her father where she's hoping to get him to confess to raping her when she was a child. He's 90 years old, shrunken from osteoporosis, and in poor health. Martha's taller and stronger, a martial artist about to test for her black belt. There are two other women present, both larger and stronger than the old man. Martha uses pseudonyms. I will use the real names of the people. Page 20. I hear a rustling sound from the coat closet, and for a moment I stop breathing. My mind produces a quick succession of catastrophic images. Sylvia, our cousin, wrestling boredom, claustrophobia, and cramped muscles until she can no longer stand it. Then bursting out of her hiding place, gasping for air and space, my father startled into a fatal heart attack. Sylvia and I are from the same extended family, which means she is combat ready to deal with my father and our confrontation. Page 84, clearly I'm not going to be able to help my father relax. The situation in the hotel room is too weirdly stressful, his position too much like that of a hostage. Seeing that I don't have a prayer of making him comfortable, I decide to make him even more uncomfortable. Page 111, even in the non-Mormon world, common courtesy would dictate that I wrap up my end of the conversation. The man is old, he's tired, he's uncomfortable. I'm sure any patient, high-minded, enlightened person would let him go right now. Me, I'm just getting started. Page 145, he looks longingly towards the hotel room door, apparently realizing I'm not about to let him leave. I'm stabbed by the pity I feel for zoo animals locked in cages that are too small for them. Page 192, my father takes off his tat, allowing me to see that his eyes are angry and afraid. He doesn't know how long I'm going to keep him here or how he's going to get home. My cousin Lydia brought him here to the hotel after dropping into my parents' home and asking if he'd like to go for a drive. I wonder how he regards Lydia right now. I'm sure he feels kidnapped, betrayed, shanghaied in the worst way. Page 245, I have to go back to work, my father tells Lydia, and once again I hear the struggle in his voice, half of him still in the role of the adult commanding children, the other half helplessly dependent on Lydia for transportation. Oh, sweetie, Lydia says to him, don't you know that this is the most important work you'll ever do, this here, talking to your daughter and your niece? I need to get to the book, says my father angrily. But, Dad, I say, nobody cares about your silly book. Martha tricked a frail and sick old man, ambushed him, confined him against his will, put his life in danger, harassed him, threatened him, kept him confined when he asked to leave, stripped him of any freedom to control his life and body, denied him access to his medications and his support network, all in complete defiance of accepted therapeutic practices. And when she saw that he was miserable, she intentionally worked to increase his pain. Through all of this, Martha was completely unsuccessful in coercing the hoped-for confession. I've heard a lot about how funny Martha's book is. Forgive me if I don't see the humor in elderly abuse. Sylvia, you were there, hiding in the closet. You could have stopped the torture. Shame on you. Love is more than calling people sweetie as you manipulate them. Love suffereth long and is kind. Love envieth not. Love vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up, doth not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not her own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil, rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoiceth in the truth. I witnessed real love for Hugh Nibley, my nephew Philip, who had to wash the shit off him, my brother Tom changing his diaper, my mother's constant care, feeding him with a spoon when he got too weak. Where was Martha when she might have given some comfort to her beloved father's last hours, working with Random House on a media campaign to destroy him? The greatest insult has been how Martha claims that in death, Dad is closer to her and loves her better than those who stood by him. Martha got that idea from a third-hand quote a sister shared with her out of love, and which Martha immediately took to the media and, in grand narcissistic fashion, turned against her. Martha got the quote wrong, but it has since been canonized into internal truth by the gospel, according to People magazine. So, what about reconciliation? Can I ever be reconciled with Martha? The wounds of Martha's abuse are fresh and raw. You should probably ask me about them in 10 years. I know this much. I will do everything I can in my own spiritual life to move beyond the pain. I find powerful hope in some examples. That moving photograph of Pope John Paul sitting in quiet conversation in a jail cell with the man who shot him. Viktor Frankl, the victim of Auschwitz, who seems to indicate forgiveness as possible even for those who ran the death camps. The truth and reconciliation process in South Africa to heal the wounds of apartheid. If those people can find peace, perhaps my wounds can heal too. But let's be clear. John Paul didn't campaign to get Mehmet Ali Agca out of jail, and Viktor Frankl didn't spend his afternoons over tea with his Auschwitz guards. And the South African truth and reconciliation process is not without enormous turmoil. There can be no reconciliation without truth. And narcissism is a disorder that refuses to recognize itself. Unlike other severely disturbed people, narcissists, with their charm and public relations skills, are found running governments and corporations rather than in hospitals. According to Dr. Vaknin, narcissism is incurable and virtually untreatable, not a promising scenario. My greatest hope comes from Dad, the most forgiving person I ever knew. Not long before he died, we were talking about whether we should replace a painting by Martha that hangs in the living room. Dad said, "No. Let's leave it up to remember when Martha was good. I will always love my sister. I will mourn her, and I will miss her. Perhaps one day I will laugh with her again. I hope so. But I will not be a facilitator to her abuse."
I was born and raised in Utah, and my parents taught each of us to develop our own faith in God, to actively cultivate that, and to pray and study and meditate and get our answers from the Spirit. I was raised with such quotes as John Taylor's, "A man in search of truth has no peculiar system to sustain, nor peculiar dogma to defend or theory to uphold. He embraces all truth, and that truth, like the sun in the firmament, shines forth and spreads its effulgent rays over all creation. And if man will divest themselves of bias and prejudice and prayerfully and conscientiously search after truth, they will find it wherever they turn their attention." I graduated from the church seminary program as well as the Institute of Religion at the University of Utah, served a mission for the church in South Africa, and saw the joy the gospel brought. It is also during my college studies that I started coming out, that started in the summer of 1983, during the middle of the AIDS scare and increasing antagonistic church rhetoric that was being heard from the pulpit and in the local and national media. Because of the fear of being ostracized by my family and church, I moved away from home. It wasn't until 1992 that I officially came out to them, though I'd been dropping hints. As far back as I can remember, I had been same-sex attracted, as the church would put it. As I learned more about God and creation, the more I was able to accept myself. The more I understood creation, the more I understood the concept of Adam and Eve as an example of relationship and not as a dictation of gender, partnership, and the eternities. But there was still a feeling that maybe the earth was a fallen state. It wasn't until I had a very spiritual experience while I was teaching in Japan, pleading and arguing with God, that I had a spiritual epiphany and confirmation that all the variations of God's creation are holy and created by God, that we are each called to accountability within our given creation, and that sanctification is based on our faith, love, and service, which breaks open the blessings of grace and eternal progression. I fully accepted my attraction as a gift from God, a gift that can be righteously used or unrighteously abused. Since 91, I've been involved with Affirmation, Gay and Lesbian Mormons, a support group to educate and education network for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, and intersex Mormons, or GLBTI. At the national level, I represent Affirmation at the National Religious Leadership Roundtable. I'm also involved with Family Fellowship, a support group for Mormon families that choose to share the burden of their GLBTI relatives, and with other groups such as Reconciliation, a gospel study group for GLBTI Mormons. Over the past 10 years, we've had a few semi-positive statements from church leaders such as Dallin Oaks, who mentioned different people are born with different physical characteristics regarding gays and lesbians. He encouraged the church leaders and members to reach out with love and understanding to those struggling with these issues. And then more recently, in 2004, President Hinckley, in an interview with Larry King, said that regarding gays and lesbians, I don't know. If we were born this way, the question is, are they born this way? Was it caused? I don't know. I'm not an expert on these things. I don't pretend to be an expert on these things. The fact is, they have a problem. What is the relationship I have with my family? Don't ask, don't tell. Like the military. I, as well as most GLBTI folks, believe in strong families and keeping commitments. I had an interesting experience a handful of years ago at a family Christmas party. My sister-in-law made decorative frames in which she mounted the proclamation on the family. One was given to my parents, the other to my sister and her family. When these gifts were opened, heartfelt thank yous were expressed, and then an uneasy quietness followed, as if an unspoken admission of some incomprehensible guilt on their part. My feeling, isolation, exclusion, the other. And my experience within and on the fringe of Mormon society, I have a new mission to educate and help individuals like myself, my family, and hopefully the church better understand sexual orientation and gender diversity. I have been involved with the earlier mentioned groups as well as with Sunstone. I speak out on GLBT issues, spirituality, and religion. In 2001, I sent a letter to general authorities, 106 or so of them, all the auxiliaries, asking a few questions and sharing a little information. And I have copies of the letter for those who are interested. I received one response back, this from a member of the Quorum of 70, someone who I'd already had face-to-face discussions with. He responded with a thank you and then said, well, you know, not all the leaders will agree with you. I have had also shared this with dozens of Latter-day Saints who email me as a contact person for Affirmation, wondering how I could call myself a gay Mormon. I've been told I'm beguiled by Satan, that my argument could justify adultery and bestiality, and that I'm misguiding people. They also ask if I've ever heard of Sodom and Gomorrah, or if I know what God told the Israelites to do to Sodomites. And some have even said that I needed to be killed and my kind wiped off the earth. There are many examples of events that have happened in Utah that exasperate the estrangement that many GLBTI people feel. These are just a couple of the hundreds of examples. These are just examples of hundreds that I could lay out. Do I feel welcomed in the church? Do I feel a part of the LDS church community? The answer is no. We talk about the great social divide in Utah between Mormons and non-Mormons. The Mormon camp, for the most part, includes alienated, disassociated, and excommunicated Mormons. I call the Great Divide more like the Grand Canyon. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Morgan Smith. I was raised in Sugar City, Idaho, to parents that were lived about as close to Christ as any people that I can think of. I want to talk about some of the positive things that come out of being estranged. A few years ago, I was working for the LDS Church, and my bishop found out that I was gay. He called me in, and the church court was held. I was, of course, excommunicated. I was told that the Spirit of the Lord would leave me and that I would be buffeted, that Satan would reign wild in my life. That was far, far from what actually happened. When I became honest with the Lord, then my life turned around and became one of happiness and joy instead of one of trepidation and fear. The Spirit of the Lord came into my life, and my life became really quite wonderful after that. After the excommunication was held, I remained with my wife for a few years, and the bad marriage became worse. I left my wife. The day that I moved out was a great one for me. My only regret was moving away from my children. I have been able to maintain a good relationship with my children. They respect me, and I love and respect them. I have also become good friends with my ex-wife, because when she calls me up angry, I say, when you can be nice to me, call me back. Goodbye. After I moved, I had a series of dreams, in one of which I dreamed I would be an influence to help people in the church understand the issues of same-sex attraction. I really wondered about that one. I was a member of Reconciliation, and I knew Ron Scow. Ron talked about forming a group in the church for parents who had gay children. One Sunday, we gathered a small group of people together and talked about the issue of helping parents. We decided that the name of the group should be Family Fellowship. Ron and I wrote the bylaws, and I got the group incorporated. And it took me several months to get tax deduction status from the IRS, but we finally managed it. In the meantime, the group took off and grew at a rapid pace. The Family Fellowship attracted many, many good families. Gary and Millie Watts were elected chairs of the group. They've been wonderful leaders, and through their efforts and others, many lives and families have been blessed. It's been wonderful to see the healing and the renewing that has occurred through Family Fellowship. The parents that are reunited with their gay children, and the children that have learned that their parents really do love them. I had a dream that my sister Wilma would find out that I was gay, and she would confront me. One evening, she knocked on my door, and she told me that she wanted to tell me about a rumor that one of my ex-wife's cousins was spreading around. And I said, well, what's the rumor? And she says, she's spreading a rumor around that you're gay. I said, do you want to know the truth? And she says, what do you mean? And I said, do you want to know whether or not I'm gay? And she says, well, are you? And I said, yes, I came out to her. that has been a tremendous blessing because she went home and her husband asked, is he gay? And she said, yes. And he said, please tell him that it doesn't make any difference to me. How really wonderful. Since then, we've had many conversations, and she has learned a lot. After that, she was called to be Relief Society president in her ward up in the Ensign Stake, and she became an excellent president because she had a greater understanding of the diversity of the people in her ward, and she was able to help people deal with issues in a healthy way. I've been fortunate to be able to help a lot of young men gain confidence and find peace and happiness in their lives. It's been quite a joy to put an arm around and to help people on their way and help them find more about their creation. Being gay is not a happenstance. It is a blessing that comes from God. In the pre-existence, this is Morgan 1:1, I believe that when Father laid his hands on his children and gave them blessings, church calls it foreordination, that he sent some of us down here with greater challenges than others. And he sent us down here to see how we would deal with it and how we would deal with it with our fellow men. Whether we would deal with it with love and compassion or whether we would go hide. I found a lot of joy and meaning in life through the events that have occurred. My life is worthwhile. It is good. It's interesting to see what good can come from getting out of a bad situation and into a healthy place. I try to deal with the issues of life with love, as we all should. Thank you for your time.
Hello, my name is Julian Hatch. I'm an unbeliever in religion. Utah Atheist received some questions if we would like to participate in this conference, and most people were reluctant. I don't know why, but they were afraid. I took the opportunity, and once again, I was born and raised in Utah. I am an unbeliever, and there's lots of things I don't believe in. There are also lots of things I do believe in. The primary thing I don't believe in is the concept of the supernatural. Theology and religion is based in the belief in the supernatural. So I technically am an atheist or a non-theist. I've not had much problem with my lack of belief in the supernatural with things like Harry Potter books, Tolkien series, or UFOs. But my lack of religious belief has caused me great problems. People take religion very seriously. For me, religion is defined as the unquestioning belief in hypothetical supernatural powers, which are to be obeyed as rulers and worshipped as creators of the universe. I've looked at a lot of definitions. I think that's what it's about. Gods would be the embodiment of the supernatural powers in religion. I do not believe there are such powers or that there is extra natural, supernatural phenomena. Nature is defined as everything that exists through time and space in the entire universe. So what they're positing in religion is something separate, something beyond nature. If that's the case, all we can really know is nature. And if we know, the supernatural appears to me to be unknowable by definition itself. If we could understand or if we could perceive of supernatural phenomena, the moment we understood it and could pin it down and perceive it, it would then become natural. It would be natural phenomena. So I think that's why people have to have faith to believe in religion. I do not have faith. When I've looked up the definition for faith, it looks like unquestioning belief. And I do have questions. I think that's the right thing to do. I think most of us all do question things. I find it difficult and possible to believe in something that's unknowable, but like most open-minded atheists, I am open to considering and debating the supernatural. Unfortunately, I've found that theists, most religious believers, generally consider unbelievers like myself as a threat. I've been labeled in court cases in recent years in southern Utah as, quote, anti-religious. And a couple of years ago, a jury in southern Utah, in Panguitch, Utah, the area where I've lived for 25 years, found a verdict against me for $162,000. They claimed that I waged a, quote, campaign of hate and terror against the, unquote, against the residents of Utah. And they said I did it for decades. Probably the main thing that started this problem was when I tried to open a microbrewery, a beer store, called Freedom from Religion. I thought it was a good idea. I figured if they wanted to drink beer, they probably weren't too Mormon or religious or whatever. So, but as I found out when the lawsuit came against me by the town clerk's husband, what he eventually said was that our town, Boulder, Utah, is a quote, Mormon cattle ranching town, unquote, and that basically I was terrorizing the citizens by putting up signs or asking for business licenses. His wife is the town clerk. She refused to give me the license. I've been targeted because I choose not to believe in religion and the supernatural, and mainly because I dare to speak out about the social oppression, and especially in these small rural areas. After several years of filing bankruptcy twice, so they couldn't sell off my property, I finally got the Utah Court of Appeals to overturn that wrongful verdict. That was last October. Unfortunately, my enemies have appealed that case to the Utah Supreme Court, where it sits today, and within the next, let's say, 6 months, I'm hoping within a year that I will get this over, that it will be reaffirmed by the Utah Supreme Court. I think they want to set precedent on this case so that this can never happen again to anyone else. I think that I've run out of time, and everybody else has gone a little longer, but I'll just try to wrap up and say I was born in 1954. My troubles began shortly after I was born in the LDS hospital in Salt Lake City. Within 2 months, our nation changed the Pledge of Allegiance, put the words "under God" in it. This was meant as an attack or a part of the Cold War against the godless communists in Russia. I don't think those people were godless, really, anyway. I don't think they ever were, and I don't think they are. I think they had a constitution that didn't include God, and I think that we tried to set our country aside, different from them, and try to attack them. Basically, what they did was attack people who do not believe in God in the United States. They hurt us a lot more than they hurt the Russians. So I think that it's not just the religious organizations that have given me my problems. And if you want, in question period, you can ask me how I got out of the Mormon Church, and I have some good stories about that. But the bottom line, I think that I would want to say about this is that the people who don't believe in religion, all we're asking for is our freedom from religion. And I don't think that we can really have freedom of religion without allowing some people to not believe if they don't want to believe. You really don't have religious freedom. So that's how I think that things are going to be reconciled. For my personal situation, what I'm seeking is justice in the court system. Every judge, almost my attorney and every other attorney I've seen in these court battles over 8 years have all been LDS. They're the ones that have these jobs in these places, and you really don't want to go before a LDS judge without an LDS attorney. Or you'll really have trouble. So the point of it is that what we need for reconciliation is justice, and the truth has to come out. I do have faith that our system does work. Unfortunately, it cost me hundreds of thousands of dollars. Unfortunately for the people who have victimized me, they're probably going to be the ones that in the end are going to have to pay my attorney fees. And so it didn't help anybody to put me through all this. We wasted a lot of time in courts and whatever and gone through a lot of pain, but eventually the truth will come out. And when it does, hopefully it'll be serve as a lesson and in court precedents that you can't do this kind of thing to other people. Thank you.
I don't deserve to be on this panel because I have never experienced estrangement. And I'm overwhelmed by the pain that I've heard, all of which I just think is terrible and a crime. I protested to Carolyn Campbell that I was only 50% qualified to be here. It's true that little of my Mormon belief system prevails today, although my Mormon lifestyle is virtually intact except for regular church attendance. But I no longer depend upon Mormon scripture nor Mormon practice to keep me doing it. Virtually all vestige of Mormon doctrine and cosmology was sloughed off in a single afternoon 30 years ago, and I've never tried to put Humpty Dumpty together again. As for estrangement, I don't know what that's about, though I did not witness the marriages of any of my 8 children and elect not to witness the martyrdom of Christ by taking the sacrament, I have consciously chosen a path that gives people little reason in the family or in the institution to focus on our differences. And if I have suffered estrangement, I don't know it. And I consider it to be of my own choosing. For the first year, I will cite a few examples of behaviors that might help you understand my plight. For the first few years, I continued to attend church services. I did not bite my tongue and found that on occasion my adrenaline was beyond management. One measure I employed was to organize my own early morning Sunday school with a few like-minded souls. Our course of study was the manuals that we would later hear if we went on to church, but we drained out all of our frustration before church started, and then we could go there happily. After that strategy, I adopted a quasi-scientific attitude and became an observer who found native customs interesting, but without considering myself one of them. I began to laugh more and cry less. But eventually, and with the assent of my long-suffering wife, I gave up after 20 years, and now I observe a peaceful Sabbath without the dangers of corruption that church-going affords. My church-going is now limited to family occasions, not even Christmas and Easter. Missionary comings and goings, ordinations, blessings, courts of honors, funerals, and so on. And when I'm asked to perform, I even stand in the priesthood circles. But I'm frequently not asked, and when I'm not, I smile and I don't. And therein is the big problem. The problem is that my behavior is simply not consistent. And I have to live with that. My best justification for this inconsistency is that the family trumps church, always. I strategically avoided challenging any family member's faith. They knew that I was dangerous, but at the same time, they knew that I didn't really threaten them on a day-to-day basis. My 4 daughters, whenever the discussion would turn toward religion, would immediately disappear, and I wouldn't see them until they were 21. While proselyting was one of the practices I disliked the most, I nevertheless supported 6 full-time missions in my family. I also made the occasion of their leaving on a mission or getting married the time when they had reached the age of accountability in my notion, and they were forced to listen to a 3-hour, no-holds-barred exposé with no rocks unturned, and that indeed became the basis for our relationship as adults. My children all knew in their... I'll skip that. I had a somewhat conspicuous church career as a member of the general board of the Mutual Improvement Association until it was disbanded by President Kimball the year that I began my own solitary journey. I know he didn't do that because of me personally. However, I was interviewed by some of my general board colleagues and several general authorities, including 2 apostles with whom I had close acquaintance. I'll spare you the details, but to my knowledge, no attempt was ever made to try me in a court, and I made no request to have my name removed from the records, etc., etc., etc. I admire those who stood up for integrity under pressure, but I'm happy that my family was spared the humiliation of my being excommunicated. On only one occasion have I been harassed by a church authority, and that was my stake president, who informed my high priest group leader that I was not to be given a forum to speak. When I confronted him, he lied. I believe he lied. My saddest moment was when my best friend, who was a prominent church employee, informed me that he didn't want to know about my journey, because, after all, he couldn't afford to have doubts raised in his own mind about the church. So that was sad. And the third incident occurred during an interview with an apostle in which he suggested that my inspiration came from the devil. I don't hold the church to blame for any of those instances. I chose my path, and they're just human beings like me. I'm almost through. A recent family event is apropos this discussion. I confessed to the majority of my children and their spouses that I had chosen a conservative course in order to avoid conflict within the family and in order to have unrestricted access to my 38 grandchildren. Many affirmed that they were aware of my efforts and thanked me for making it easy for them. Several of my older grandchildren have questioned me of late about my beliefs, and I've told them all, and I am not aware that any of these confessions have resulted in any form of alienation, either from them or from their parents. I have been treated with utmost respect by a succession of bishops in the Douglas ward, and I suspect that a lot of that has to do with the virtues of my wife, who is a devout member. It's possible that my prominence in the music community may be a factor in having escaped prosecution. My closest personal friends are about equally divided between iron rotters and atheists, and I love them all equally. With a few exceptions, I would say that the general treatment of me by local and general authorities has been exemplary. I have a letter from President Hinckley, which begins, "Dear Ardeen," and a personal invitation to his birthday party 2 years ago. I know he knows of my institutional lapses because my friend was in charge of making the file, and he attended these meetings at Sunstone, and I saw him taking the notes, which I know reside there. And it is to President Hinckley's credit, not to mine, that I can still enjoy his friendship. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Mary Beth Rains, and I'm asking that some handouts be passed out. They are of a strange nature, and so I'll get to them briefly. I would like to say from the start that for those of you who don't receive a handout, I underestimated how many people would show up at 4:45 in the afternoon on the last day. And so if you are a couple or you're with somebody who's a close friend, would you please share it so that other people who in the back may not get it may be able to share it. If you haven't received it or if you're listening to this recording, you can contact me at rains@aol.com. It's Rains M, excuse me, R-A-Y-N-E-S-M @AOL.com. Please list the name of this session because I delete unknown email addresses. Carolyn asked me to this panel in a couple of roles or a couple of hats. So let me wear the personal hat for just a moment, and then I'll move to the professional hat where I'll spend the bulk of my time. I would say that my journey and my sense of estrangement at times from my family has really followed much the same path as our dean's. I didn't have the occasion of having my face left off in all one day and one realization. Might have hoped for that. It was sort of like the Band-Aid coming off all at once, instead of very slowly over probably a 5-year period of time. But I do remember periods of time when I had sudden awareness that something didn't fit as I had known it as a child and I had constructed it as a child. And I would say those times were both wonderful and awful, both wonderful in terms of new realizations of putting the world together, and awful in knowing that something had to come apart in my life and that I had to not only put it back together again with myself, but I had to put it back together with my children and with my family. I am the oldest of 8 children. 6 of us are living. My parents and their extended family, all of my siblings, and 2 of my 3 children are very active Orthodox Mormons and always have been. I have one daughter who is a heretic along with myself. Let me give you a definition of heretic that I've always loved. It was Sterling McMurrin. He said that somebody is an apostate if they leave the religion and are basically hostile towards that religion and its belief. Somebody is a heretic if they have doctrinal disagreements, but they have a basic affection for some of those beliefs, have reworked their faith, and have some basic affection for the church and its culture, and so I define myself as that. It's been many years. It's been 25 years now, maybe upwards of almost 30 years, that I have gone through various stages of how to maintain contact with my family or at times not to discuss things. I would say that that you gave a good overview of my general strategy. I have chosen from time to time to talk directly with different members of my family, siblings and children, and we've sort of each one of us worked out or jockeyed our own little arrangement about how much we're going to talk about the church and the differences in our belief and how much we're going to go where we simply share a belief or a concern or at least a family ritual and not talk about it. And that's been a step-by-step journey rather than a general overall practice. At the moment, I feel delighted where I am with the church. I had a wonderful therapy supervisor who, at one point when I asked him about his beliefs, he'd been a minister before becoming a therapist, he said, I'm at that place in life where I can believe several things at once, and it's all okay. And I would say that's probably true for me at this point. So my process of coming back together to my family has been a step-by-step, slowly pulling back together, talking it through, but it has had its own difficulties, and I'm sure that in one way or another all of you have. I'd like to put on my therapist hat now for a moment because Carolyn asked me if I would talk about estrangement generally and whether, in fact, what applies there, I mean, estrangement in families, let me say that, through alienation of various crises of different sorts, and what may often happen there, and then is there anything different about a church estrangement or alienation within a family regarding church beliefs or practices. Let me say first that I think that most estrangements around church beliefs and practices follow really somewhat the same model as those with other kinds of crises. The reality is when estrangement about the church comes, about belief or practice, or whether one is gay or whether one doesn't believe, or whether the story of one's parents is markedly disparate and fought over, hits the same deep chord of hurt and anger and disappointment and feeling left out and feeling unattached or rejected regardless of the issue. We're talking about church estrangement today, so let me move more towards that and see how they apply to general estrangement as well as particular. I would guess when that deep cord of splitting or deep cord of hurt or pain occurs, it's much like any traumatic reaction or a time when we feel that we need to be defensive. And there are basically four routes that people take when that's the case. The two are very, very, very common. We know about fight or flight. And a lot of us will enter that fight or flight reaction depending on what our preference is. A third one is called freeze. Many people, unable to do either or not know which course to take or both seem viable, will freeze for a while. And the fourth is in research recently by a large study of women under stress, and they will typically take what is called a tend and befriend reaction. They will reach out to other people or do a lot of caretaking and nurturing under those same kinds of situations that other people might fight, flight, or freeze. I would like to propose that we actually do all of those. Every one of us have some of those in our repertoire. We've chosen different routes at different times, and so we're all inconsistent, Ardine. Three of us have searched out what strategy fits what, but I think we all are. We're trying to put together an integrated life, and much like the rug on the floor, there are many elements and colors and maybe even designs, but we try to fit them together. Let me move to the handouts that I gave you. I only thought this morning about doing these handouts, and they come from other sources and other papers and other workshop presentations, so let me explain them so they make some sense, and then I'll bring them around to estrangement over church issues. The first, I am very much interested in developmental stages over the year, and anybody who talks to me for a while knows that that's sort of the lens I look through. It's a multiplex lens. So anytime there's an issue that comes through, rather than dividing out into either or, it will almost be like a light through a prism, and I'll see a range of colors, a range of ways to see it. And the way I've organized it over time with the help of many psychologists and developmental theories and Ken Wilber, who I've talked about earlier, I think developmentally, and so when somebody responds, I think, where are they, or what are they speaking from, or where am I speaking from at the time, or what's the sensibility? So your first chart is actually made for another unpublished paper on the stages of romance in relationships. And it is, however, a concise overview of the developmental stages that we go through as people around how we view ourselves, others, how we care, how we have compassion, what our moral reasoning is, which is at the core of how we struggle or how we repair or how we create any bridges for the estrangement and differences in our families. If you'll think about it, there are many places that families allow a lot of differences. And in those places, there isn't estrangement. They've simply located a place for those differences because they're not core beliefs necessarily, or they have that as a family way of speaking about things, about how people are different, within a range of acceptability. When it falls outside that range, however, and people act in that fight, flight, freeze, maybe hopefully tend to befriend, but sometimes not often. At least that's not happened among our panelists much, it sounds like. Families will tend to be at the stage 3 or 4 on your chart. So I gave you the first chart called Stages of Romance. The second and third charts are from a presentation I gave on parents' reaction to gay youth and their coming out process a year ago at a psychological association meeting and conference. And so if you look at the second and third pages, let's start with the second for the moment. The second page gives a family's capabilities, or a person's capabilities for reacting to a crisis that is deeply threatening. At the third stage, you're called egocentric stage. And the egocentric stage is essentially where your ways of viewing the world are either right or powerful, or they just are, and everybody else is wrong. It's a bifurcated black or white world, and it's organized centrally around power or around command and capitulation in any kind of conflict resolution. If your family members, or if you yourself, have a primary center of gravity, shall we speak, at that stage, there really will not be any lasting resolution that will beyond how we agree to maybe be nice in certain situations. But sitting down to a full-hearted discussion, or where we can find common bridges, or how we can lend our hearts to each other, really will not occur. And one of the very sad things is to realize sometimes that either some family members of ours are not up to that kind of discussion. And we do the greatest kindness by not either pushing it. I'm not saying we should rescind our own rights and our own way of life and so on, but that we essentially don't try to push and push and push where we know there's not going to be any interpersonal resolution. In fact, I think one of the saddest things I see again and again and again is a person holding, who is estranged from their family around reasons of belief, around reasons of action, around those other sorts of things, is to hold an idealistic view that someday their parent or their sibling or the church leader will someday come around and really hear them and understand them. There's a funny quote I saw, it's a cartoon, years ago about work on inner child work, when persons go in and really look at their past and how they reacted at one time or another. And the cartoon showed a series of efforts on the part of this person to go in and down to open the various doors inside him or herself, and the inner children kept coming out and screaming and talking and whatever. And the last frame of the cartoon, the person comes running out of this inner work and goes, "I'm just beginning to wonder, is there an inner adult in there?" For people who are at the egocentric stage, there is no inner adult. So you may not find that. Or you may find in some ways, if you go to church and sit together, for instance, or you have some family reunion ritual, then people show up as a more adult. But when you go to the depth of where the hurt or the pain or where you want to be loved with indifference, you may not find it. Let's look at the third page on your handout. People who then move up to the fourth stage, which is the conventional stage, which is really where the bulk of American society is, the bulk of the educated world gets to, who are kind of either pre-college training or they are emotionally not developed, to be able to see two or three views at once. That would be stage five. But there's stage four. They're conventional. This is where the bulk of the membership of the church would be, and it's also the bulk of where most of American society is. At that point, we come into a place where we can agree on basic rules of law, basic rules of kindness and fairness. So you can have civil conversation. You can have ideas about bridging where we are similar and allowing respect for where we are different. If you, and keep in mind, sometimes when we get into these discussions, we move to the egocentric stage and we're right and they're wrong and we're furious. Or as one of my supervisors pointed out to me one time, you know, sometimes black sheep in a family act like black sheep. So I think it's important to pay attention to how we are responding and acting in a situation, not just how we think other family members are. But essentially, ring the bell when you think I need to be through, okay? but essentially, in this stage, we actually can start to develop some bridges. And the handouts are more a greater length and more depth than we can explain here, so please play with them at home or think about them. But at this stage, you can start to do some strategies. And for the most part, you can create islands of peace if you keep going into the next stage, which is only briefly synopsized on that first chart. You can actually do continents of peace, where you can really take the place of the other, which I'll get to in just a moment. But essentially, it's helpful to really assess where you are and where the other person is, not in a judgmental way, but just saying, this is where it is. You know, I'm in Nevada and you're in Wisconsin, and we're that far apart, and we can only have certain kinds of contact, versus we're neighbors down the street, so to speak. We can walk across and sit in each other's living room. The place where real reconciliation occurs, I mean, there's some reconciliation that can occur in that area, and it starts at the end of that stage of development, where people can sit down and listen and understand that the other person has a point of view and a way of seeing things that are just as important to them as yours are to you. And then you actually move it to stage five. That's the continental divide of emotional development in my mind, where you really can reach full reconciliation, where you can sit down and eventually get to the point, which I hope at some point you do with your sister, where you can sit down and realize, oh my gosh, didn't I act this way when that happened? Didn't I act this way when I happened? And I really understand that for you, Duane, that being gay is as compelling and interesting and as enlightening for you, or you, for you, Morgan, as, as my being straight and that thrill of attraction that comes when I'm really interested in somebody. And that's just as viable and just as important, and may you have as much joy. In fact, maybe you have more joy than I do. I don't know. I should ask. So that's the kind of conversation that can come in the next stage. Let me end with the last. There are two more handouts. All of these handouts were actually written for therapists, but I think that there's too much therapist speak to each other and not enough lay speak to each other, so I'm assuming everybody can understand all of this. Turns out therapists are no more intelligent than anybody else, and we've just developed our own esoteric language like every profession has. So if you look at the fourth sheet, that is a sheet about how to handle a family crisis, and it's again organized around how to respond when a family has a gay youth coming out. But I adapted it from an article about how to deal with affairs when an affair is disclosed within a marriage. And it is widely flexible. Frank Pittman, who wrote that, essentially is one of the more famous marriage and family therapists around, who maintains you can't be married and right at the same time. And so he gives a kind of a process that people can go through to build confidence that you can actually build some bridges. And then the last handout is also from the sort of same school of thought among marriage and family therapists, in which if we look at where things already work, if we look at where we have conflict, and then when we're not having conflict, how do we manage the same difficulty but don't have conflict about it? And so I've just passed you sort of a synopsis of a chapter in a marriage and family therapy text as ways of just giving ideas and seeding that we may, point by point, an act of compassion by act of compassion, find bridges across the places where we are really, really different. Thanks.
Okay, we would like to turn the time over to you to ask questions of the panel members now. Yes.
I'm the designated babysitter on those occasions. And it's a role I would rather have than being inside.
Any other questions?
And how about that afternoon 30 years ago?
It's a long, long story, but it was basically an epiphany that instead of confirming everything that had happened in the first 45 years, did just the opposite. It was instantaneous, and it was everything. And as far as I know, it was not preceded by any angst on my part. I was not dissatisfied. I'd never been hurt. Life in the church had been very, very good to me. I had to get used to thinking about it in different ways because, in essence, God told me to go out, and I obeyed.
Other questions? I would like to ask Alex. Alex, did you ever imagine that you and Martha, growing up, when did you first realize that there was this pain? What was the first thing that happened?
Between me and Martha, or between Martha and the family?
Between Martha and the family.
Come to the mic.
Okay.
Martha was always an exceptional and extraordinary child, but in saying that, there were seven other exceptional and extraordinary children in the home. Some of the ways in which Martha was exceptional and extraordinary is that she demanded the limelight. She was, from a very early age, a raging terror when she didn't get her own way. I'm sure Mary Beth can explain more about this than I can, but the dynamics of a large and complex family like that are, you know, Byzantine in their complexity. Martha was always manipulative and controlling. And probably we first started to get real worries when Martha went anorexic as a teenager. And I mean, we'd always say, oh, she's so bright, she's so wonderful, blah, blah, blah. We began going, may have some problems here when she went anorexic, and the family got her into therapy and got her over that hump, et cetera. But would you confirm that, Zina? I mean, Zina was like that with Martha growing up. And I think it's when the anorexia came that was the first real warning I had.
Any other questions from the audience? Yeah.
I guess this question is addressed to Mary Beth. I facilitate a group of people who are in conflict with Mormonism or are post-Mormons. It's hard to find the language for post-Mormons, ex-Mormons. One of the things that's evident in our group is that a change of religious opinion on the part of the member of our group is met oftentimes by a lot of fear on the part of their faithful spouse, to the point where people cannot listen to each other, to the point where people freeze and back out of the room, where they talk that, like other people are under the influence of Satan. I think a lot of this connects to Mormon history with the image of heretics and of apostates is a pretty dark thing. Do you have any suggestions for reducing that tension and that level of fear and enhancing communication?
This is a big one because not just because there might be fear about what happens if somebody believes differently and therefore they won't be with you in the next life. I think there's a current phrase that's going around that people are worried if somebody doesn't believe or isn't faithful, that there will be an empty place at the table in the next life, and it's a phrase I've heard. So essentially what happens is that your basic attachment to the other person you love and are planning on spending the rest of your life with and forever with is now at threat. And most people get married, if they're getting married and both are faithful or active members in the church, on the premise and within the framework that the church not only is true, but that it has a right to seal and you will be through eternity, and if you don't remain faithful, that you won't. So it's the same thing as pulling out somebody's basic cord for breath, and it hits people at that direction, in that depth. It's the same feeling. It's just a basic survival instinct many people have. And when we are hit that strong in our emotional system, we don't have words. We don't have regular cognitive reasoning. We are into that fight or flight or trying to get breath or what to do next. And most of us will regress. Most of us will use our most primitive, least effective, and therefore least loving interventions to start with. And so what does one do when that happens? But that's the reason. There's a biochemical reason that now our amygdala emotional brain is speaking, which is always two or three developmental levels below our rational level. So heaven help that you have at least a rational level that's moving upwards, right, to get your emotional level. Also, people don't have the ability to calm in those circumstances. But I think there are things you can do. First of all, it is important to affirm, I think, what you do believe in. And keep in mind, when you're going through a crisis of faith yourself, you don't know that. That's all up. And all the puzzles in the box and the pieces in the box get, thrown up, and you don't even know what the new puzzle, what the picture in the box looks like, if there ever is one. And so soothing, going back to the rituals within the marriage or ways you have loved the person in particular, in ways that were beyond or are somehow not connected to entirely a discussion of church belief or non-belief. Because when we get married, if we really are in love, there are ways that are in that framework, but there are ways that you love that particular person. Their idiosyncrasies, their strengths, the experiences you've had together, and calling that back up will often, and finding ways to go back to the rituals or the activities or the ways you were when that came about, when you were first sort of in love, or the best parts of the relationship, or the best parts of the connection, then that helps soothe and stabilize not just our emotional selves, but it stabilizes that connection over time, and for some people gives hope over the long run. If you are in a relationship where, or with your spouse or family members, where there's a lot of fractures anyway, and you don't have a good resounding sense of we and us, it's really, really difficult, because now you don't have a lot of strings to pull on. You don't have a lot of bridges to go over in some sort of ways. The other thing I think you can do sometimes is to really search through your own beliefs that transcend the either or of Satan or Savior kind of ideas in what you believe in, the deep principles of kindness or honesty. You may have some the religious belief left about God or about Christ, and you can appeal to those. You may have whatever you have. Find ways that you can commonly bridge and state what you do believe in or what still seems to make deep sense. And that often works also, I think. I think you can also use some other points of Mormon doctrine that may be helpful. Not everybody would agree with this, but there's a couple that I think make sense. One of them is what I call the millennial loophole. And that is, even though we may not emphasize it a lot and we focus on doing our work here in this probation, as it were, there's 1,000 years after the resurrection in Mormon doctrine in which things will be good. And we'll get to work a lot of things out. And, in fact, the church relies on this belief when things get sorted about, like, if somebody's married to somebody in the temple and then that person dies and the woman then marries again, which husband is she really going to choose? And it used to be that you couldn't, and now you can. I mean, now they've expanded that a bit. Are there other decisions deferred, shall we put it? And so sometimes you say, I don't actually know, because I'm coming from my best experience and my deepest caring about you, but I don't actually know, and I'm hoping something works out. The other one that you can often use is, if you think about it, when there's any sealing within the temple or any covenant of that sort, particularly the marriage covenant, it's a promise of sealing. We don't speak about it much, but there is a second endowment, which is a permanent sealing. And that sealing rests upon two things, the covenant, right, and then the relationship. And the relationship has to be a warm, loving, connected relationship over time and in eternities for it to be viable, right? So you can appeal to building the relationship. That to you is such an important ingredient, and that you really want to build that and pull that together, whether it's with your children, whether it's with your spouse, with whomever, and that hopefully that will get worked out somehow as you come to have more connection together with each other. I'm sure there are many strategies around. We might ask the audience themselves what they've used.
Would anyone in the audience like to comment on a strategy that has worked for you in an estrangement situation or in a conflict situation? Would any of the panelists like to say more about that? No? Okay. Well, I appreciate everyone coming and being here today. And like Mary Beth said, the last session of the last day on a Saturday and nice weather and all of that. Appreciate all of you coming, and thank you very much.